This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about homelessness in Indiana. A program at the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development is awarding $100 million spread out over a dozen cities in the state. We'll find out where that money might go and what the last year has done to change issues around homelessness and the ongoing efforts to help. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. With us now, we have two guests. Chelsea Herring-Cozy is Executive Director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, or CHIP, and Jeff Bennett is Deputy Mayor of Community Development for the City of Indianapolis. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Jeff, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us a sense of how much money this is coming from HUD's American Rescue Plan?
Well, so we're still getting the full picture of what the American Rescue Plan will bring to the city. There have been some individual announcements, and most recently we've been informed that we're receiving about $15 million in one specific source of funds that flows through HUD, which is called the Home Investment Partnerships Program. And that is a that source of funds has a wide range of uses. And we believe we will have the federal guidance on how we can spend that money later this summer. And then the ARP has other sources of funds that will come through undoubtedly to Indianapolis, including a chunk of funds for just for local government assistance, as well as rental assistance and we think some other programs. So, you know, that this source of funds or these sources of funds on top of the CARES Act 1 and CARES Act 2 funds that we received in 2020 can really help us make a significant difference in the implementation of our community plan to end homelessness.
Mm-hmm. And how does this funding fit into what you typically receive for efforts around homelessness?
It is remarkable. So any given year, we receive roughly between $7 and $8 million through a single federal program that's called the HUD Continuum of Care, which is specifically for homelessness intervention and permanent supportive housing. We've already received more than that amount through the CARES Act, upwards of $11 million through CARES Act 1 and 2 funds that we've deployed for homelessness response and for permanent housing. So that overnight doubled our community's ability to respond. And with the ARP, mm-hmm. we could see another increase of similar size.
Okay. And before we get into more about the money coming in and where it'll go, I want to ask Chelsea, can you tell us a little bit about what CHIP does for those who may not know?
Sure, Miriam, I'd be glad to. So CHIP is considered a backbone agency. And what that means is we are not directly working with individuals and households experiencing homelessness, but really supporting the broad network of providers that are doing that work on the ground and with individuals and households. So we're working to support providers through capacity building, helping to continue to secure and leverage funding and make sure it's directed in a way that aligns with the strategies and priorities in our community plan to end homelessness. We support data collection and analysis to really understand how homelessness is changing and how we're making an impact and where we might have gaps. We help oversee and manage what's called the coordinated entry system, which is a way of really assessing household needs and making sure that folks are matched with the best housing and service resources to resolve their homelessness. And we do some policy advocacy because we know that a big part of this work is also making sure that we have policies and legislation in place that support housing and permanent solutions and really unpack some of the deeper rooted issues in why homelessness is what it is in our community.
And how does this money from HUD affect your organization?
So it doesn't affect CHIP specifically, but as Jeff said, what it does is it brings an infusion of resources to really elevate the work of our community plan. as Jeff mentioned, I mean, the CARES Act funding one and two and what may be coming through the American Relief Plan or Recovery Plan has more than doubled our typical annual allocation. And what's really significant is because we already have a plan in place and we know what the solutions are and where we need to invest that money, it's really allowing us to bring more housing solutions to the table. So it's working alongside community partners to make sure that we are continuing to focus on those permanent solutions. And it's allowed us to partner in some new ways. And so the funding doesn't necessarily affect, you know, CHIP specifically. It affects our entire collective and really elevates the work being done around the community plan to end homelessness.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, when it comes to this money coming in from the American Rescue Plan, do you know when you're going to receive it and how you're going to allocate it?
We have an idea of when we're going to receive it. So we anticipate receiving the first sort of tranche of this money about this time next month. And then when it comes to the state and local governmental assistance fund, we'll receive a second round of funding a year from May. So, but as it relates to some of the specific sources, whether it's rental assistance or the home program funds that I mentioned, those we think we will receive at about the same time. What ends up happening, though, is it takes the money gets here before the guidance on how we can spend it. So we will proceed with a little bit of caution at the beginning so we don't get too far out over our skis on spending money without federal guidance. But by summer, I think we'll be deploying those funds into community programs, including our homelessness response. And that's a similar approach that we took last year when we received the CARES Act 1 funds in March. It took a little while, a couple of months, to get federal guidance. And then by June, we were before the City County Council trying to appropriate those funds. So we will likely start that council appropriation process in May. And then over the course of the summer, begin to get it out into the community on top of the CARES Act dollars from last year.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on what the federal guidance looks like when it comes to these kinds of things?
I mean, it really is a here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. And we have some early indication from the Biden administration that they would like to be as comprehensive as they can be the first time guidance is issued, so that the guidance doesn't change over time, which sometimes happens when you're dealing with a federal response of this size.
Mm-hmm. Have there been, I'm just curious hearing that they tell you what you can and can't do. Have there been instances in the past where people have spent money on things that they weren't supposed to? Is that why there are rules in place?
That is absolutely true. Yeah. And you know, it has not been something that has affected Indianapolis, but I do know that other cities have you know, had audit findings in future years based on the way that those federal funds were expended. We're really careful about that. And we have a really solid federal grants team internally and externally who help give us the sort of guardrails. And a few of us who've been around, you know, going back to the 2008 recession when there was an influx of federal funds and federal guidance that came in, we kind of have muscle memory from those federal programs, and that's helpful in a case like this.
Now, Chelsea, earlier this year, it was announced that CHIP would be changing the way it collects data on the homeless population. Can you tell us a little bit more about how things are changing?
Sure, Miriam. Again, we collect data at all year long, but one of the probably most known ways in which we collect data is through the annual point in time count, which is a one night kind of snapshot or census of homelessness in communities. And so this year, just with COVID, we had to adjust the way in which the point in time count was conducted, because we typically rely on upwards of 70 volunteers the night of the point in time count to go out and really help collect data and engage with those living unsheltered specifically. And because we couldn't do that this year, we worked really closely with the professional blended street outreach teams, which are teams of professional outreach workers that do this day in and day out, mm-hmm. and spread that count over the course of a week, still looking at a one night census. but really relied on the PBSO teams to do the heavy lifting this year to ensure that we still were able to do a point in time count, that it is as accurate as possible, but we stayed safe and really relied on the professionals to do that. That's one example, but you know, throughout the year, we continue to refine the way in which we collect data to ensure greater accuracy, completeness, and high quality so that we have a really good understanding of what homelessness looks like, how it's changing, who's impacted. Not all folks are impacted the same. We know that there's significant disparity in homelessness here in Indianapolis, specifically by race. And so our data really allows us to see that in more real time. And where we're working towards getting is being able to really utilize real-time data in a way that allows us to drive decision-making, help align funding when we see, you know, where things are working and where things aren't, and to really adjust strategies. And so those data collection efforts have been really vital during, you know, the pandemic. We were able to use our data systems to help track COVID screenings and testing and to make sure people were getting connected to the health department and to quarantine and isolation sites. We're starting to explore how our data collection can be used to help coordinate care around vaccinations. So, you know, having data, I think, is really vital for communities to really be more sophisticated in how they understand and address homelessness, and particularly using data to drive high performance, right? We want to really understand what's working and what's not, and then make sure that strategies are being driven through an equity lens. And so data helps answer those questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with our guests after that break. We're talking about homelessness in Indianapolis and across the state. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about issues around homelessness during the pandemic. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. With us today are two guests, Chelsea Herring-Cozy, Executive Director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, or CHIP, and Jeff Bennett, Deputy Mayor of Community Development for the City of Indianapolis. Jeff, HUD just released its 2020 report on homelessness, and it showed that nationwide between 2019 and 2020, homelessness increased significantly among unsheltered populations and people experiencing chronic homelessness. Did this trend happen in Indianapolis as well?
So it's interesting. We have seen an overall reduction in homelessness in Indianapolis. I guess we're pending the 2020 point in time count data that's, you know, coming out in the next few weeks. But over the last 4 years, we've seen a reduction overall. But to your point, the one place where we've seen an uptick, a noticeable uptick, is in unsheltered homeless and chronically homeless. And so in this regard, I think Indianapolis is like many other cities. The numbers that we face locally are maybe not to the extent that some other cities that face. But for us, it's a significant number. And it's it has caused us to, I think, to continue to evolve our thinking around response. And it certainly informed our decisions for deployment of 2020 federal resources that came to us through CARES Act 1 and 2.
And Chelsea, have you seen that impact as well?
Yeah, again, to Jeff's point, so we are still waiting on the 2021 point in time count data, which we anticipate having in the next couple of weeks. And that will really give a snapshot. Again, it is a one night, but it is a snapshot that we can compare what things look like January of 2020 before the pandemic and then after. We've not seen, to Jeff's point, the kind of increase that HUD is showing nationally in their 2020 report on homelessness. Indianapolis has not seen the kinds of increases other cities have. But as Jeff mentioned, we are paying attention to what's happening in terms of unsheltered homelessness and where there may be gaps in our services. We're anticipating, really trying to understand better how the pandemic has affected those experiencing homelessness and potentially those that may be new to homelessness. But I'm hopeful because, again, Indianapolis has not seen the kinds of increases that some of our other peer cities have across the country. And what we are kind of seeing here in Indianapolis, we have the ability to solve it. We really have the ability, and with the resources coming in, not just through the CARES Act 1 and 2 last year, but what may be coming, are really going to be significant in making a big impact on homelessness here in Indianapolis, because the numbers that we see and the people behind those numbers are something that we absolutely believe we can solve for and make mm-hmm. a significant impact.
And when you say solve it, I mean, is this something that would happen overnight, or is this something that is going to be a process to get towards?
It will be a process. I mean, none of this happens overnight. And I want to be clear on kind of what we mean by solving. It does not mean that an individual or a household may not experience a housing crisis that results in having to come into shelter. But what it means is that we want to reduce the time any household spends experiencing homelessness to 30 days or less. And we also want to vastly reduce the amount of time anyone spends unsheltered. To have a shelter system that is responsive and low barrier enough that anyone can come in and receive kind of that crisis soft landing, and that shelter is then a quick pathway to housing. We know that housing is what the solution is. And so the goal is to really create a response system that provides inclusive, low barrier places for people who are in housing crisis to land and then quickly get back connected to housing. And Miriam, what it also means is that we're working a little more upstream to try to divert individuals and households who are having a housing crisis from having to come into shelter at all, and really deploying strategies and resources to divert and prevent that homeless episode from happening in the first place.
And speaking of housing, Jeff, before the pandemic, the Hogsett administration was putting a focus on permanent supportive housing as part of its push to end chronic homelessness. What is permanent supportive housing? What exactly does that entail?
Well, first of all, the focus on permanent housing, it really just reflects what national best practices have shown us, which is that the solution to homelessness is permanent housing. It's getting a household stabilized in permanent housing as quickly as possible. There are some households who need a little bit more. And so when we talk about supportive housing, that is rental assistance plus the type of supportive services that are necessary to keep someone housed. And that the level and the array of services will differ from household to household based on needs. But sometimes it's mental health care. Sometimes it's maybe addiction recovery treatment. Sometimes it is just some support on how to be a good tenant. And it really varies on a case-by-case basis. But we want to ensure that we have a local system that is set up to meet a household where they are, and get them rehoused as quickly as possible with the services that they need to remain housed permanently. And the proof has been in the pudding. Like, over the last 2 years, we've had a significant retention rate, a very, very small rate of households who have fallen back into homelessness when we have put rental assistance together with supportive services. I think Chelsea, correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that we're still over 90% in terms of our retention rate for households that we've housed permanently.
And would you say, I mean, it sounds like Indiana's, or at least Indianapolis is kind of getting things together in this realm. Would you say you're a model city for other cities across the nation?
We have a really good plan, a really good local plan. We are just past the halfway point of the five-year plan. It was developed over many months with hundreds input from hundreds of organizations locally. And we just focus on our plan. Are we a model? I like to think we are, and we certainly have had conversations with other cities about our plan. And we get often asked, you know, what have we learned from other cities, whether it's related to pandemic response or community plan and homelessness. And I think we can make the case that other cities are learning from us on this issue, as well as on our pandemic response and CARES Act deployment.
Mm-hmm. And Chelsea, I'd ask you the same thing. I mean, where does Indiana stand, or even Indianapolis, compared to other big cities across the country? And I guess I'm wondering, do you interact with other states to see what they're doing?
We do. I think a couple things I want to highlight. One is that we very much believe in the power of peer learning and sharing what we know and what's working here with our peer cities, and also learning from peer cities what's working there. And so I think one of the strengths of, or if there's a silver lining in, you know, this past year, is we've been able to much more intentionally and more easily connect with peer cities through technical assistance from HUD, and through creating just really intentional partnerships with other cities, as we're all kind of trying to figure this out together and pivot in the midst of a public health pandemic. So that peer learning is vital. The other thing I want to say, you know, to Jeff's point, is having a set of priorities and shared values matters. So the fact that we've had this community plan in place, I can't speak to the strength of that, because it clearly articulates, here's what the priorities are in Indianapolis, and there's shared buy-in to those priorities. And there's a vision and set of shared values around housing, around housing first, and what we believe the solutions are. I don't want to minimize or simplify how hard this work is. It does take, I mean, not to sound cliche, it takes a village. And where we have strength in Indianapolis is that we have a village that is very coordinated. Our provider community and partners have come together for a long time, but I think that's even been strengthened and made stronger this past year during the pandemic, of people coming together in a really coordinated way to problem solve together, to reaffirm our priorities and our commitment to housing and permanent housing, and to figure out how we do this when we're being asked and have the opportunity to, as Jeff said, house almost double the amount of households we typically do in an annual basis based on the additional funding coming. That's a big lift. I mean, we're asking our community to kind of, in a short period of time, double the amount of work and coordination that they're doing to get folks connected to housing. And that's no easy ask. But what we've seen is our community rally around it and try to figure out how to pivot and problem solve together. And that type of coordination, I think, really does set Indianapolis apart in some ways, and really makes us a strong community in this kind of response.
Mm-hmm. So far, I feel like what I'm hearing from both of you is there's a lot of not just hope, but seeing that things are changing and for the better and hopefully improving for the homeless population. But how did the pandemic affect all this? You know, Jeff, I'm curious. Did it make the population grow? You know, folks who are out of work and now they're just a paycheck away from rent, and now they're out of housing. How is that being balanced with all of this?
Well, to answer your second thought first, you know, we tried to and continue to address the issue of households that are sort of one paycheck away through a separate source of rental assistance. So we deployed almost. Mm-hmm. $34 million in rental assistance in 2020 to nearly 16,000 households. And, you know, based on some of the early data that we've seen related to evictions, is that it doesn't look like evictions increased noticeably over a normal year in Indianapolis. Now, we know normal years are always bad in terms of evictions in Indianapolis, but we staved off maybe a wave of evictions on top of that were specifically pandemic related, and we're back at it with the rental assistance program right now with another $30+ million to be able to deploy. But as it relates to our most vulnerable residents, those who are experiencing homelessness or those who are on the verge, like, our initial response as a community was a crisis response. You think about this: all of the agencies that serve this vulnerable population were shutting down last March. They couldn't have their doors open. They couldn't meet in person. They couldn't provide the type of services that they normally would, because everyone was shifting to remote and no personal contact. And all of our shelters are congregate settings with dorm-like sleeping arrangements in the middle of a respiratory pandemic. So we spent a significant amount of time in March, April, and May last year getting people out of congregate shelters and into, at the first, we were sleeping people in parks facilities to get them separated safely so that we weren't causing disease spread. And then we moved into a program that we continue to have up and running, which is a relationship with several hotels locally to master lease hotel rooms so we can have individual sleeping arrangements for people while we transition into them into permanent housing. And so from the crisis response, as the federal funds began to arrive in Indianapolis, like, we could pretty quickly look at our community plan and what it identified as needs pending funding and put our funding into those needs. So you get from there, you get a pretty short line to $10 million in emergency solutions grant funding that came through the CARES Act for a program called Rapid Rehousing, which will house between 500 and 700 households permanently with a year's worth of rental assistance paid basically up front. So we went from crisis response immediately back to implementation of the community plan, now with a once in a century deployment of available resources.
Once in a century, that's pretty impactful.
Yeah, I mean, there's really been nothing like this scale since the New Deal.
Wow, that's huge. I'm trying to wrap my head around that. So Chelsea, what were the first months of the pandemic like for CHIP, and how did that impact what you were doing?
Yeah, as Jeff said, we had to pretty quickly pivot to crisis response, and again, to helping coordinate and support our partners in reimagining shelter, in bringing some new options to the table. I can't say enough how fortunate Indianapolis has been been, because we've been selected multiple times to receive pretty intense technical assistance from HUD to really respond in the pandemic. So we quickly organized and started convening with the city, with the Marion County Health Department, with the Family and Social Services Administration to put together a strategic crisis response that, you know, Jeff really highlighted. How do we reduce congregate sheltering? How do we make sure to get resources deployed to those living unsheltered? And then how do we set up non-congregate options to keep households safe in the midst of a public health crisis? I mean, COVID was scary for all of us, but imagine how scary it is if you don't have a home to quarantine in, to isolate in, to recover safely in. And so the first step was to really provide those safe places. But at the same time, we knew that they were temporary. So once these partnerships got set up and there were non-congregate options for those experiencing homelessness, then the notion was, how do we then pivot and really start targeting investment and efforts to a rehousing response so that there is housing at the end of this? And that's where we are now. And like I said, it's not an easy lift. It doesn't happen overnight. But we have teams in place and finally the kinds of resources to bring to bear to really make housing a reality for those who are living unhoused right now. But it's a tight market. You know, as Jeff said, at the same time, there have been efforts through not just the eviction moratorium, but through rental assistance to make sure people stay in housing. And so, you know, it really does require that two-prong approach, keeping people in housing and preventing people from losing housing, while also bringing more housing to the table for those that aren't with housing right now. So we're asking for, you know, landlords to come to the table and problem solve with us, help us fill any vacant units we have. We have resources to bring to the table, you know, ask about and learn about the rental assistance programs that are becoming available and that are being scaled. And so it really does require expanded partnership and understanding of this work.
Well, we'll be taking a quick break, and when we come back, I do want to ask a little bit more about this rental assistance. We're talking with local leaders about homelessness in Indiana and how the pandemic has changed things. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So back now to our discussion on homelessness in Indiana with our two guests, Chelsea Herring-Cozy, Executive Director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, or CHIP, and Jeff Bennett, Deputy Mayor of Community Development for the City of Indianapolis. Chelsea, before the break, we briefly touched upon rental assistance, and I know you and Jeff have both been talking about this a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? And the reason I ask is because for some folks, this might sound so complicated, like how do you even figure this out? Is there paperwork involved? You know, what if someone doesn't have a computer to fill out the form? You know, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. And that is a great question, because I wish it was very simple. And I can't say that it is very simple. But what's nice is that there are teams of people across partner agencies that are really helping walk alongside people to navigate this process. So when we talk about rental assistance in the homeless response system, what we're primarily talking about is what Jeff mentioned, rapid rehousing, which is time-limited rental assistance to really help get households back into housing and stabilize. And typically in our community, we've used rapid rehousing rental assistance, you know, for short periods of time, 3 to 6 months is how it's traditionally been used. And during that time, then households are working with a housing case manager to really, you know, address any gaps to be able to stabilize housing in the long term, get connected to income support or better employment opportunities. But we've approached this differently in response to COVID, because we're using rapid rehousing as a housing response to a public health crisis. And we're arguing people need longer term rental assistance because of loss of income and employment. And so rapid rehousing is really being used to provide 12 months of rental assistance to support to households who are needing to get back into housing after, you know, experiencing homelessness. And it's really being targeted right now at those who have been most vulnerable in the midst of a public health crisis. So a lot of the households that have been at the non-congregate hotel site that are in high risk categories as determined by the CDC and public health department, and those that are living unsheltered, who we know face different kinds of challenges and vulnerability. And so there is a housing acquisition team through partnership with Merchants Affordable Housing that is really helping kind of on the landlord side, work with landlords, bring more units to the table, and help educate landlords on what these rental assistance programs are. And then there are housing navigation teams that are working with our partner agencies, HIP, Aspire, Adult and Child, Sandra Eskenazi, Horizon House, HVAF, Coburn Place, have these positions called housing navigators that really help work with the households through this process. What documents do you need to be able to get connected to housing? You know, what are the right housing interventions to really meet the household needs? What kind of units are people looking for? What parts of town? So there are teams in place that are really helping walk alongside folks to not have to navigate this on their own.
And I do want to take a moment. We have a listener voicemail from Suzanne who has a question. Let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Suzanne from Martinsville. Your comments about what you're doing sound great, but I'd like you to comment on something I heard on NPR the other day, that Indiana leads or is second highest in the U.S. in evictions right at this time. That's got to have an impact on homelessness and other problems. Can you put that into the context, the facts? Thanks.
So I don't know, Jeff, if you want to answer that.
Yeah, I could start. I mean, this caller's absolutely right. You know, during a quote-unquote normal year, Indianapolis is among the highest cities for evictions in the country, and compared with cities way larger than us, you know, we'll have 12 to 14,000 evictions during a normal year. And so when we were, you know, we made some changes to city ordinance at the beginning of 2020 that we hoped would begin to tip the balance a little bit back into the favor of a tenant in the tenant landlord relationship. And unfortunately, the state legislature preempted us and took that authority away from local government to be able to inform tenants of their rights and responsibilities in the rental situation. And so we had hoped that that act would have, you know, would have begun the slow process of reducing the number of evictions during normal times. And what we ended up doing with the rental assistance program, the Indy Rent program, during the pandemic was to say, okay, we have high evictions. Let's not make it worse during a pandemic. Let's do all we can to stave off what we were hearing could have been 20,000 or more additional evictions that were due to pandemic-related job loss or hours reduction resulting in an inability to pay rent. Anecdotally, so far, that those additional evictions have not occurred, which, you know, then allows us to focus back on the original challenge. And so, you know, we've begun to take a little bit of a different approach when it comes to normal evictions by partnering with Indiana Legal Services, Neighbor Christian Legal Clinic, and others to ensure that tenants have access to counsel if they are facing an eviction proceeding. Statistics have shown over recent years that a tenant who has representation has a much better outcome rather than a tenant going in with no one by their side into a courtroom that's going to feel intimidating and knowing that the landlord likely has counsel. So we're investing in legal assistance, and we will continue to invest in rental assistance. And hopefully by combining those two, we can have an impact over time on the normal high number of evictions that take place in Marion County.
All right. Well, thank you both. We are just about out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time joining us this afternoon and shedding light on this issue.
Thanks for having us.
I want to thank all our guests for taking the time today. Chelsea Herring-Cozy, Executive Director of the Coalition for Homelessness Intervention and Prevention, or CHIP, and Jeff Bennett is Deputy Mayor of Community Development for the City of Indianapolis. Now we're going to head over to Fort Wayne. I spoke yesterday with Kelly Lundberg, Deputy Director of the Fort Wayne Housing and Neighborhood Services, to find out how these issues look there and to find out why it's been reported that children make up most of the city's homeless population. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
So Fort Wayne is getting just over $4 million as part of the American Rescue Plan Initiative from HUD. Before we get into the details, how significant is this for your community and your efforts around homelessness?
I think I and the rest of the city administration really view this as almost a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make some pretty significant changes to our network and just infrastructure of services and shelters to address homelessness in Fort Wayne.
And you described it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. What are you planning to do with the money?
Through part of our initial COVID relief funds that we got from HUD, we just kicked off and have underway a plan that is going to actually look at the needs and our current services and help us identify exactly what our gaps are. And so I'm hopeful that this allocation of $4 million will help us fill some of those gaps. So, for instance, one thing that came up pretty early on is we didn't have a shelter for single unaccompanied women. And so one of our first investments with the initial COVID relief funds was to assist in the renovation of a brand new emergency women's shelter.
And you mentioned there's some gaps, and that's one of the things that you're working on is this shelter. What about, I mean, are there any other big needs you have in Fort Wayne right now around homelessness?
Yes, so absolutely. Some of the other initial things, you know, that we found is, especially during the cooler months, just having a daytime shelter for people to go to. We had some existing shelters and services. However, when the pandemic struck, A lot of things were scaled back to allow for social distancing. And so I guess then the question became, you know, how can we build almost a pandemic strategy in case something like this happens again to make sure that we're ready?
This $4 million, it may sound like a lot to some people, but in the grand scheme of things, $4 million isn't really that much. What more money do you need besides this? Like this might help with some things, but do you think there's a lot more stuff that needs to be taken care of?
Yes, absolutely. I think, obviously I don't have like a full dollar amount of what we would need to fully address the needs, but, we do know that not only, you know, does it take money to acquire and rehab structures, to act as shelters, but there's a lot of ongoing operational costs and a lot of wraparound services that are really provided to ensure that these shelters are successful in hopefully, I guess, preventing reoccurring or chronic homelessness. So there's really no one solution to addressing homelessness. It's just really such a complex issue. And the people that are experiencing homelessness really need a lot of services.
Right, right. And how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted people experiencing homelessness? Did you see an increase in folks looking for services?
Yes, I think from our service providers, we were hearing that that the request for financial assistance and housing had tripled in many cases. And I know some agencies had reported over a 200% increase in like the number of calls they were having asking for help. So we know that there are a lot of people out there that are still hurting.
Mm-hmm. And what about the folks that are homeless? How did the pandemic hit that community?
It really hit our unsheltered population particularly hard, especially when all of our local businesses and facilities had to shut down. If you think about it, basically their access to even basic restroom facilities and stuff was greatly decreased. And so at that point in time, it was kind of quickly trying to find porta potties and portable hand washing stations and trying to figure out, you know, how can we help these people?
Right, right. And I would imagine, something like a virus spreading rampantly in folks that don't have access to resources like masks and things like that, it must have been pretty difficult.
And so, especially the unsheltered homeless, they tend to live, they're very communal. And so they're especially high risk for, such a contagious virus. And so they were particularly, at risk for, catching COVID and, you know, even the little things that maybe the rest of us take for granted, but a lot of them, their access to services is through phones and, even finding a place to charge their cell phones, when everything was shut down was difficult.
Right. Well, have there been any, efforts to, I guess, provide health resources to homeless populations, for example, the COVID-19 vaccine?
Yes, actually. So one of our early endeavors was opening a day shelter and then overnight shelter for unaccompanied women. And I know the state and our local Department of Health came in and offered the vaccine to the people there at our shelter.
Mm-hmm. We did hear from leaders in Indianapolis that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was a core part of their strategy with the homeless population because it was one shot, not two, which tends to be good for people who might be moving around. Has that been an issue for you, especially now with the pause on that vaccine?
I have not heard anything, but I think they were implementing the same strategy here in Fort Wayne with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I'm hopeful that they got most of the reoccurring people are already vaccinated.
Are there any challenges that you think, maybe our listeners or people that you know, may pass by homeless folks and don't really know what they're going through. Are there any things that I guess what I'm wondering is what can the average person do to help?
I would suggest, you know, reaching out to the shelters and the street outreach groups that are really trying to work and help. A lot of times they operate off of donations and even volunteer time. Like I know we're funding a rehab of a shelter up here, but you know, they're looking for volunteers to help offset their costs with things like painting. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I think, you know, we all have some capacity to give and to do something that will help out.
Well, earlier this year, there were reports from homeless advocates that said most of the homeless population in Fort Wayne were children. Is there any data to show this, or is this accurate?
So I've heard that too. We don't really have great data. That's one outcome that we're really hoping to get from our homelessness prevention strategy. So every year we do a point in time count, but we know there are a lot of people that are couch surfing or maybe living in their cars or some other places that just aren't being captured in those numbers. And so we're hoping to get something a little more accurate through this mm-hmm. Plan.
And, you know, as we get ready to wrap up here, what are some of the lasting impacts you think the pandemic might have on your efforts around homelessness?
So the pandemic really exposed a lot of the vulnerabilities of our local system. And so I really think that one thing we've noticed is the more communal shelters are obviously really high risk. And so they had to cut back on the number of people that they were able to shelter at one time, which meant they couldn't serve as many people. So it's those types of longer lasting impacts that I think that we're really going to look at. You know, how can we pandemic proof our shelters to make sure that, you know, we're ready and we can continue to adequately serve people as needed?
Well, thank you so much, Kelly, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Kelly Lundberg is Deputy Director of the Fort Wayne Housing and Neighborhood Services. Our producers are Drew Doblin, Micah Gayson, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on fitness and health during the pandemic. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.